The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still, to a large extent,
live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Inside Critical Theory brings you this Diet Soap interview.
Yeah, so let me just read your bio and we'll get going. So are you recently married, by the way? Did you just get married recently? Or?
I'm married. I'm here in the UK doing teletherapy. So, yeah.
Oh, are you doing teletherapy with your old clients back in Los Angeles?
Well, no, I'm using I'm not doing therapy via the clinic, which was LA Public Health funded, but I have private clients, which I do teletherapy. And then I'm a gig economy plus worker as well. So like I work through BetterHelp, right? So they will basically give you an infinite amount of clients because they have a lot more clients than therapists. So you just kind of open your availability and then they send you a bunch of clients for slightly less than market rate. It's still pretty good.
Well,
so that's why I'm like a DoorDash plus therapist as well.
You're a DoorDash plus therapist. That's going in. I think that may be part of the title. DoorDash therapy.
DoorDash therapy, exactly.
In an ego-less world, maybe. All right, so I'm going to start with questions about that before. Okay, I'll read your bio. Elliot Rosenstock is a therapist living in the UK and the author of The Ego and Its Hyperstate and also Zizek and the Clinic, which were two books that I published while I was at Zero Books. Elliot was also the host of a YouTube show called The Anti-Advice Show for a little while, and he's a fun interlocutor. Elliot, welcome back, or welcome for the first time to this new channel.
Thanks, Doug.
You were just saying you were a DoorDash therapist.
Exactly.
I'm in therapy.
It keeps me grounded as well. I'm sorry to interrupt. The last thing I'll say is it keeps you grounded because you can do as much philosophy as you want, but ultimately, if half your practice is like DoorDash therapy, you got to like bring it down to the level of like something that works as a universal kind of subject therapist.
Right. Well, I'm in therapy for the first time in a long, long time. I was in therapy when I was a teenager for a little while. I'm in therapy for like a particular reason, which I think will eventually subside, like my grief, basically.
Grief's always fun. Grief's great, Doug, because it's one of the most real things that you can experience as a human. If you're wondering what's real, grief will do it. Grief's a good place to start. Why is that? It's just so overwhelming. You get everything with grief. You get trauma. You get some nice trauma dreams with grief. You get depression with grief. Everything is nothing because of the grief. You get neurosis from grief. Getting over the grief. It's like, I'm going to get over it. And then it's like, how can I get over it? Because I need to hold on to it.
I definitely feel that. Let's talk about that for a moment.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I'm betraying myself
as
I start to get over the grief.
Right.
I don't want to let go of the feeling of loss, because that would be the true loss, is to let go of it.
It's one way to look at it, but there's a couple ways that we could go with this.
Okay.
And this would go into the book, which is the power of myth. We could expand on the myth, which is like betraying the grief, right? Or we could look for an essential component, which kind of subverts the narrative, which is kind of like Freud and Jung. Freud is like the great subverter, and that's why I like Freud. And Jung is the great mythologizer. You get this kind of essence versus myth thing coming up, rather than kind of existence and essence, essence and myth. Anyway, let's talk about the
thing. Explain to me. I'm just gonna exploit you as a DoorDash therapist this whole time. Forget about all my questions about your
Please
book.
Do, because
okay,
please.
Because. My question is, like, what is the compulsion? What's behind the compulsion to hold on to grief? And is there, is that where you're starting to veer into melancholy?
I think part of it is a failure of imagination a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's also it's obsession along, because there's a point where what would an ideal outcome of grief is in terms of what is the contradiction in getting over your grief? Well, you're forgetting the thing that was important to you, or the person, or the relationship, right? Mm-hmm. That was important to you. So this is the contradiction. The way that there is an essential way to sublate this contradiction, right? For sublation books, right? So let's talk about sublating, right? Mm-hmm. So this contradiction could be sublated if somehow you could access the memory more fully of the grief object, or whoever is the person or relationship, if you could access the memory and you practice this, this would overcome the need for the overwhelming grief sensation, because you are doing this also formal respect of the thing that you feel like you're disrespecting by avoiding grief, right? Or getting over grief a little bit. In practice, it's very difficult, and it requires, like, you know, it's like a constant thing, because there's stages, right? And I don't mean like the five stages of grief. I mean, like, you'll forget it sometimes, because you have to forget it sometimes, because sometimes you're like eating dinner and you're not thinking, you're not grieving. So yeah. But I mean, if you could, I think there, my big belief is there is a rational, essential essence, right? This is like the fundamental thing which drives all my theory, theory. 30-year-old DoorDash therapist theory. but nonetheless, DoorDash, I think
look,
I'm
DoorDash
good.
Therapy, the theory of DoorDash therapy. That's another book. You should write that book next.
And outside of the internet, in the clinic, it was like, oh, Ellie, oh yeah, he's good. His patients like him. In DoorDash therapy, like, I get like good DoorDash therapist reviews, right? So this is like the translation out of the imaginary into the symbolic. Me castrated is like, okay, you actually can do therapy with people. Ultimately,
yeah. Right. That's good. So, but
I like this because I get to enjoy the imaginary a little bit, and we get to talk the theory and
right. So just to go back around it. So let's talk about the ego here a little bit in grief.
Yeah.
What is the ego trying to do by when it's holding on to grief, or what is the grieving process for in terms of? I guess fortifying the ego, is that the way to think about it?
Sure. There's a problem. There's the Freudian kind of ego, and then there's the ego as I described, kind of this process of articulating in terms of what's being articulated, right? Mm-hmm. When you're articulating the grief, what is the actual, like, the very first chapter is the Freudian molecule. Like, if you read The Interpretation of Dreams, the thing that really stood out for me is condensation. I feel like condensation, the fact of lots of different things coming together in a dream to make one object, which has a bunch of different origins, right? So if you can articulate the grief in a certain way, I think the ego wants to ignore it. The ego, initially, you'd want to just not articulate it because it's painful, obviously. So the ego is either trying to articulate the grief or not articulate the grief. And the problem is it's a double bind, because you articulate it and you feel bad. You ignore it, you feel bad. You can sublate this hypothetically by articulating it and not grieving the pain of grief. But then the problem with that is also pain. You're not necessarily just trying to avoid pain as well. I like shame. Shame's a great emotion. It's a very un-American emotion. That's like one of my favorite emotions. I think when I feel like a little bit of shame, I'm like, oh, this is good, because now I'm going to, now this is directing me in a way. I feel like really grounded, right? So you know,
I think I prefer guilt over shame.
You like guilt over shame?
Yeah, because shame is about who the being, about who you are. It's a it's feeling ashamed is you're feeling like the whatever you've done or whatever has gone wrong, you feel like it's an indictment of your character, of your essence. Whereas,
but this is the Freudian ego, though. This is where this can come. And because, like, what's wrong with having an indictment of your character, right? The Freudian ego wants to maintain its image of itself as positive. But wouldn't it be interesting if it wasn't all positive?
Right. Well, no, I mean, right. But if you, but the problem with that is with shame, you don't have the capacity to look forward and recognize that your essence is malleable. With guilt, it's something you've done. It's some action, some approach that you've done that you feel was wrong and that you feel guilty for doing, but you then have the capacity, you're still within the realm of being able to act differently, to do
so. For you, shame is stagnation, unchangeable concreteness,
right? Yeah. And you get mired
in that. I watch my
kid
that,
like I watch my kid and I'll say, you didn't do your homework. I told you to do your homework and you just sat there and you didn't. And there was a problem that you didn't overcome with like using the online system or whatever. And I said, what stopped you? And instead of saying, I'm sorry, I feel guilty, I got lazy or distracted, he'll say, oh, I'm a bad person. There's something wrong with me.
Well, there's a bit of a cop out there, isn't it?
Yeah, it turns into a shame. It turns into shame.
Well, shame also then alleviates the task, the labor of doing it, doesn't it?
Right, a little bit of a cop. Yeah.
This is why condensation is so fun, because there's always different essential qualities, right?
Right. Yeah. Explain what you mean by that. How explain condensation?
When you said shame is unchanging, I don't associate change with shame necessary. I guess maybe a little bit, but for you, shame is, you know, you could, in the Lacanian sense, it's a battery of signifiers, right? Shame has unchangingness, being. But for me, as a second person who doesn't have this battery in my unconscious so much, what I see is this being actually the way it essentially functions, which is not as, this is why I like dialectical therapy in the Hegelian sense, which is the way it truly functions, is that you then get to cut out of labor, right? Which is, this is essentially true whether or not this was a product of your psyche. It is true, right? So this is like a nice shortcut to be a good therapist, because other therapists don't do this, which is they say, oh, this is your psychic product, this is what you really meant, or this is what you could do to be more efficient. But if you want to like have a little edge, you can kind of see, well, this and this also essentially means this is happening. What do you think of that? And I go, wow, that is true, isn't it? And then you can.
Okay. So rather, let me just see if I can understand what you're saying. What you'll do is you'll look at the process that's creating a symptom, whether it's a shame or grief.
And yeah. Well, I'll see essential products of it. Right.
Of the process, like though.
Because
you said like this and this creates,
but it's
this.
Rationally understood in a moment. Like it's not when I'm rationally understanding it, the process is creating this thing, which is not, it has a process, but I would say more essentially is it's unity. It's singular synthetic unity. Like for instance, all of history or your life has a process, but it wouldn't it be interesting if we looked at it as a singular thing, such as a pen, right? It's a singular thing. And you can do that, in fact. And, you know, it's rational to do that even.
If I take a person and I say, okay, I'm going to examine their entire life up to the age of 35.
Yes.
They're 35.
Yes.
And I'm going to consider them as who they are right now by taking the totality of the known data about their life.
One problem with that, instead of doing all of your past, kind of makes sense. You no longer say you're older than 35. you no longer can access that as subject. Now it's only object. And then there's also history now. So if you take your past up to now as a single object, that's a much more dynamic object than 0 to 35. That's a less dynamic object. We could, there, you can act, but I think you are correct.
Well, I was positing a question.
Yeah, I think
now,
you are correct. Yeah,
now
yeah.
For them would be 35. I'm just saying someone who's not me.
Oh, got it. Got right? it. So someone who's 35. Yeah, that, well, they could do that. But I think you're also, you know, right. You can split up a life and say, okay, 0 to 35. And
Right. That, I'm just saying, that can be I was specifically taking a hypothetical subject who was younger than I was, so and just to, so, for whatever yeah. reasons.
So younger so like, than 37.
Yeah, I'm 37. Right. 51. But okay, right. So let's say you take a person, whatever age they might be,
yeah,
but they're an adult, and you say, okay, what are we going to do? We're going to create a narrative of your history that we then understand as an essence?
Or no, because that's a myth. That's the opposite of a sense. So like, I think in the book, I want to say it very clearly, which is like, there's this mode of essence. Essence subverts. And there's this mode of myth. And myth expands. It's different. Myth carries with it a certain force. And most of the force of myth is underneath it. Essence is different because you're bringing the force forward, which has a different effect. It actually kind of subverts itself in a lot of ways, or it can empower itself. But it's a more rational object in terms of it's more self-aimed. It equals itself more than myth, which kind of equals something else more, like a narrative, like a movie with like a plot, with, like a Hemingway story, where you don't even know what the fuck the plot is, and you read it and then they say, you get it? And I go, no, it's like, it's about an abortion. It's about what? And you read it again, it's like, oh,
feels
okay.
Like white elephants. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's the YA.
Yeah, yeah. okay, so, all right, so let me see if I can get this in even more theoretical terms, because there's, in psychoanalysis, there's the triad of the psyche, right? There's the id, the superego, and the ego. And it seems to me like you might be approaching this triad from another triad. And you have Freud, Lacan, and Jung, right? So you have three versions of...
Oh, don't do me like that, Doug. Don't mythologize me like that. Get that away. No.
Okay. Sorry. I'm trying to schematize. I'm trying to say, okay, how do we think of the Freudian triad? How do we think of the Lacanian triad?
Right.
How do we think of the Jungian triad? So, but what's your objection to me framing it that way?
Well, it's I would say I engage with Freud in Lacan, informed by Lacan a bit. But there are like real Lacanians. I like Hegel a lot and dialectical analysis a lot. Jung is just kind of, I don't like Jung so much. I don't like art. I don't like, you have to invest in a cult of a certain archetype and you have to say it's real, it's essence, but it's not essence. You
know? Okay. Yeah, that's fine. So we can be very critical of that third, the Jungian triad, but we can set it apart and say, this is something we're critical of. But it's something that you bring up.
So the way I see superego, I would say for me, anytime you have I see it through Hegel mostly, in terms of more than Lacan. And I read Freud through Hegel quite a lot, which is like when you unify something, you create superego, which is tension, which keeps it together. It's the superego is saying, I want to break this apart, right? Anything that says here's something, for me, superego is the opposite force, which wants to break it, which wants to pick at it, right? That for me is superego. It's critical, right? We know superego is critical. It can be unconscious. It can be conscious. The id can be unconscious and conscious. The ego can be unconscious and conscious for Freud. Freud is a very kind of unique read of this. But for me, like, I think of the ego and the id in one. That's that. I think I don't have a triad. I would say I more have a unity of kind of ego and id. It's kind of hard for me to separate the two, although you could do a Freudian nuance. But for me, it's easy to think of it essentially as one. But superego, I see as outside of that. I see as like superego is this kind of force which pulls, which it's like there's something that wants to negate it. There's something that wants to kind of antithesize or break apart.
Right. Okay. So what I think of the ego, I think of I or me or the singular perspective, right? I might think of the ego as being Doug, but most of the time it's just I, just sort of empty ego, right? But and you're saying that with the id and with the id and ego being kind of sort of the same entity, that the ego is maybe the I that is negotiating the desire it has. Would that be?
But the problem is the I can take the form of Angelina or like Angelino. And then you can even further do that. And I say Los Angeles is a nice place to be. And I live in Los Angeles. Right. And now your ego is gone. Now it's totally mystified. And you're like, oh, now, and you know, a simple psychology reading would be like, oh, you're talking about the outside. You're not talking about the I, ergo, you're not talking about yourself. And this is where my big complaint with, this is why this is like kind of psychological egoism, which is the I or the agency of self-interest by virtue of the fact of you existing actually where you are and articulating. This is an essential thing, which is this is the true ego. This is the true kind of, this is the real thing. And this is the real thing that kind of I chart in terms of like the hyperstate, which is self-interest. In terms of this agency and then how it creates and then what it creates then transforms and how those transformations interact with other transformations of self, other.
Okay. So let me see if I can understand what you're saying here. So I started to explain what the ego was as a kind of empty I. Right. And that then would be negotiating with the id and desire. And you said, well, but the ego, the way I think of the ego is it has an objective component to it. It is, it's situated in a real place. It has a concreteness, a reality to it. It's embodied.
Doug, think of a fungi. Think of like, you know, what do you call those things in the lake? The little disease things that you see floating and swimming. Yeah,
I don't know.
Amoeba. Think of like an amoeba. You see like an amoeba kind of mosey. I would argue that amoeba is always acting in its self interest in some way. And you can analyze it and be like, oh, it's self-regulatory, right? It's getting food, right? It's breathing oxygen, right? But I would say the sum of this in any moment is a rational unity that you could call self-interest. Then I would also say, humans do the same thing.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. This makes sense. So like you're going to say like almost a Marxist sort of take here. You're going to say you can't consider the I and its relationship to the id outside of the material context in which it's operating. So whatever that I, however that I conceives of itself in the psyche is informed by its mode of surviving and reproducing itself, and that's its self-interest.
Well, but those are still ideas because I would say just very simply, it's a body in unity, in this movement, whatever movement it does is self-interest. And I mean, you can analyze why, right?
But I mean, ideas are important because the difference between an amoeba and a human being is that the human being can one of the big things is that a human being theoretically anyway can change its environment consciously and directly in itself.
If I was an amoeba scientist,
you couldn't. There's no such thing. There's no such thing as an amoeba scientist. That's sure my there. Point. No,
there's microbiologists or something. Whatever.
Oh, an amoeba. Oh, you mean a human scientist who studies amoeba?
Oh, yes. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. Not an amoeba who is a scientist. So let's get analytic philosophy. There are no amoebas who are scientists.
Okay. Yes.
This week we've reached a point of agreement. If nothing else.
We know this. Okay. So So what is the difference? Okay, so let's go through it again. There's the id. There's the ego. There's the superego. The id and the ego, in your conception, are combined into a kind of essence, and that essence is embodied. It has self-interest that defines its body, right? That directs it. Am I on the right track here?
Okay. Yes. What we can rationally understand is self-interest, which is this process of desiring, but really it's just being in the world, whatever it is doing.
So, I mean,
it's pushed there by something.
Kind of this egoistic perspective, which is not, that's not meant to be a slur on it, but it's like you're saying, like, let's say you take an altruistic act, you look at it.
I would say it's a psychological perspective, most it can be understood as this is a psychological perspective.
Right. If I'm at war in Vietnam and a grenade comes over or there's a mine on the ground and I recognize that and I throw myself on the grenade to protect my comrades and the troop, right?
Yeah. I had an uncle who did that in Vietnam.
Yeah, right. Okay, there you go. And that was his ego did that as out of self-interest.
He identified as a member of the squad, but then the thing is this is in my book, which is it still good, right? I would say just because this is true about self-interest doesn't mean good is still a rational thing. So what is good? Saving lives. That's in terms of what's good. Is collecting bottle caps and recycling them good? Maybe saving lives. That's pretty universal from like China.
Right.
Right. So he saved lives. We can rationally understand it as this act.
But he did that in service of his own,
agency, consciousness,
and ego, and
his consciousness made him do it.
Right. It was out of his own self-interest.
But I would you want to paint a bad picture, I'll paint an even worse picture.
I'm not trying to paint a bad picture.
No, I want to paint a worse picture, though.
You're having an ego defensive reaction to me. I'm just trying to
understand. I would say if you're sterner, he would be, you could say he was spooked, right, by his memory, his language, his very existence, but not just his existence. Right, but this essential memory and language compelled him, pushed him, and that's what I like. Force it pushed him onto the grid. Right. Mm-hmm. This is like how I see it, which is there's these forces that move articulate us and articulate the world. Right.
And how does the id, operate within the ego's, construct of memory and self-conception? I mean, go ahead.
It's hard to say because I think Freud did the id as well as it's going to get. I would say Freud is like the theorist of the id, and you're not going to really get better. I think when he expanded on sexuality, on death drive, and how this initial drive expands itself into civilization, right? Right. You could say, he did this id-wise because maybe at home he had to be the person for the woman. So now he gets pushed in front of the grenade by these forces in the world, pushed onto the grenade, and he saves lives and he's a hero, and everything's, this is the id, I would say. I don't really have much to add except like Aquinas adds like Aristotle to Christianity. I would just say that this is better understood, more, it's, there's a higher understanding of this, less from that kind, I would even call it like even now, like evo psych angle. I would say evo psych does the id a little, is very id focused branch, right? Mm-hmm. But I feel like it doesn't quite tell us enough, and it guesses a lot, right? And Freud guessed a lot. Freud, you switch out the necktie because you want to exchange your penis, right? This is a guess of the id. But nonetheless, there is this kind of possible process, right?
Hmm. Well, we could talk about neckties. I originally bought a necktie for the first time in years and years and years to go on a date on New Year's Eve. Maybe I was wanting a new penis.
Did you want a new penis or did you want to, I would say, or did you want to be formal? Did you want to enter into the form of the date? Right.
That I wanted, I wanted to dress appropriately to go out on New Year's Eve to a ballroom where there was going to be a show and, you know,
bring the ballroom. Exactly. So this is why I think, you know, to understand.
But a ballroom, balling.
This is the danger of knowing of speaking to me, which is there is a purpose to form. Form has a function, and essentialism destroys form always. As soon as you start essentializing form, form is kind of a myth. And you can extend it. You can wear a tie, you can go out, and then you say, oh, you're doing this because this. It's like, okay, great, but now I'm treating the form like a symptom a little bit, and now I'm kind of self-reflecting on something in a way that may not really add to form itself, which is what you really want, right? So I would say there's something to ties besides their possible penis value. or even the essential quality of it. The fact that you wore the tie and you did this, I would, you know.
We could psychoanalyze my entire outfit for that night. Like I wore a t-shirt underneath my button-up shirt, and the t-shirt under my button-up shirts was an OK Boomer meme shirt that I was wearing.
What did he mean by this? Yeah, we could go
into. Yeah, we could go into like. And I had a conversation with a woman who I've seen in the past, who's sort of more of a friend now. And I said I was wearing it under my shirt, and she said, "Don't do that, because this person you're going on a date with might see that shirt." And I said, "Nah, not a chance. That's, you know." And anyway, we won't go beyond that point. So the point is,
she saw the shirt, and then
there was a moment where the shirt was revealed. Let's see. Going back to my notes, getting away from my love life.
It's a problem with psychology.
I end up all this self-revelation. Although I'll also say that since I've left Zero Books, a lot more of the content I've done has been a little more, it's been more personal. Not that it wasn't before, but like, you know, I've doing this show now with my kid Noah called Zoomer Philosophy, and it's just the two of us bantering.
I've seen one or two of those.
I the one of the first interviews I did was all about Tinder with Susanna Kleeman, where we talked about dating and things, and I would have probably not done that on the Zero Books channel because I was ensconced in the role
I don't think the Zero Books formality delivers what formality should, which is ideally if you're publishing, you're doing something formal, then it's taking your ideas and self somewhere. But I think on at this point, especially with like kind of new people, it doesn't, second half of the show.
Well, yeah, we'll talk about that in the parent room for the patrons. What is the hyperstate? How does it relate to myth?
The ego's right, all that. The hyperstate is, like I said, the agency. The hyperstate is the totality, so the absolute hyperstate, which is the last one. The totality of all that agency thing I was talking about, how there is a you are this in any particular moment. The absolute hyperstate is all of that through time, through every human being. Right, that's the absolute hyperstate, which is the kind of the actual synthetic content. Right. Your hyperstate in terms of is kind of this historical process. Why is this articulating? What is being kind of understood rationally? Right. What are you entering into? Entering into superego unity, but also eros and superego are very. This is the great part about like rationality, because you can find things out unless you're off the map. And I think I'm not off the map on this one, which is when you unify, there is this tension. And there's also the eros feeling. So eros is this superego, or you just cannot escape. They're like one in the same process. Whenever you unify, you get the enjoyment and you get the tension of its disillusion. So the absolute hyperstate is kind of the totality of these kind of choices. So the ego and the hyperstate is just understanding the ego as this, like I said, the amoeba self, which is you're doing this because this is your self-interest. We define this as self-interest, whatever you're doing in the moment. That's like that. And the reason I did this was that psychological egoism studies, when I looked them up, I only looked them up because I didn't want to study egoism when I was young and optimistic and full of Bernie Sanders. I might have been before Bernie Sanders.
It was before Bernie, but I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
But when I was in grad school, I studied altruism. Mm-hmm. I've definitely gone a different direction. But when I studied altruism, I found psychological egoism. And then I read it and I was like, this seems like not very good. Like, it seemed like all the sources I kept finding on this idea that everything you do is in your self-interest went to places that weren't saying enough. There was like things you do this because it's in your family's interest and you're a part of your family. You're doing this because it's in your community's interest. And I wanted to really take it to its like absolute rational end, right? Which is it's an axiomatic argument, which I don't think the axiom is bad, which is any particular moment you can define as self-interest. And then what is the consequence of that? Right. And that's kind of that's the hyperstate, the understanding of this. Oh, and what's the relation to myth? Like you said, this is a reflection of, it kind of takes power of myth. Takes away the power of myth, I would say, a lot of the time.
I've been talking to Todd McGowan lately. Talked to him a couple of times, and I'm actually reading his book Enjoyment Right and Left, which is we're going to publish, and it's quite interesting and good. One of the way he starts out the book is by describing what enjoyment is as opposed to pleasure, which I think
this is a direction, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So enjoyment and pleasure are two different things. Fair.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, usually you don't think of them as different, that you enjoy the pleasures in life, you know, that kind of
thing. Well, if you read Lacan, I think it's in, like I said, in the theory that I have, which is like,
It's a particularly Lacanian perspective.
Yeah.
I think the word that he would be really playing with is jouissance or something like that for enjoyment. Enjoyment, the way he uses it, is excessive enjoyment. He says that you're really enjoying something when it becomes a threat to you, your process of taking in the pleasure. So he gives an example of like having
skin in the game.
Yeah, having an ice cream.
Yeah,
you might take pleasure in the ice cream, but eating strawberry ice cream on the lawn on a hot summer day to the point where you feel mildly sick, then you're really enjoying it. Right. Eating an excessive amount of ice cream or getting brain freeze from the ice cream, you know, risking the way I would think of it is like eating just enough so you start to feel that brain freeze come on.
Sure.
Playing around at the border, the liminal space between.
Now you're in a sense rationally what you're talking about there is the ideal pleasure, which is not the pleasure sensation. What is rational pleasure, which is danger.
Right.
Right.
Access. It's like that where you're on the liminal boundary between normal pleasure and it kind of going wrong, maybe.
I think another way you could read Lacan here is, you know, through the Rosenstock method TM, not yet, maybe. Mm-hmm. Anyway, is that he's creating a molecule of you say pleasure, but actually your definition of pleasure is the problem is not that it's wrong. It's that it's not pleasurable enough. It's too empty. It doesn't do it for Lacan. Right. So we talk about other signifiers of pleasure, excess, pain, even right. Now you have a Freudian molecule. It's a word because it is just a word in the end.
Enjoyment,
which just enjoyment, and now it has more power because it's actually fulfilling the promise of itself more in a certain
right.
way.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, enjoyment always leaves you a little not like unsatisfied at the end, because you're not, unless you're, I would say, even if you're supposedly enlightened Tibetan monk or whatever.
Right. Yeah. So what I was wondering is, how does self-interest and that kind of enjoyment that McGowan talks about mm-hmm. operate together?
Like I said, it operates. Oh, so if you direct,
it seems like that excessive enjoyment might cut against what rationally is in your.
Well, there's also a diremption, so it sends you on a vector. So this is why I write vectors of self-interest, right? Mm-hmm. Or you might even say, I'm a dime, just to insult myself, because I wouldn't be enjoying if I didn't insult myself. Dime store, Deleuze here, line or whatever. But I think of a vector, like in terms of vectors, are like perfect. Like this is a perfect direction. It's not a vague direction. In terms of, if you direct enjoyment, and say Lacan says your synthetic enjoyment, which is excess, is directed from the simple pleasure, which is actually impossible and also kind of nothing. Now you're attuned mentally to this where this appears. Where does enjoyment as excess appear? You could look at like a concert, you could see where excess is happening, you could see where people are in pain a little bit, you could see where it's not enough, right? So now you have now you're putting the glasses on, right? And now you're seeing the world in this complex way, right? So Lacan kind of offers you this complex ideology glasses that Todd McGowan is saying this is also helps you put on as well, right? Mm-hmm. So in that way, like a thinker like me who's very essentialist, exact, rational, this what I don't offer that Lacan offers mm-hmm. is these kind of like poetic, artistic lenses which show you the world in this particular way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's what I admire about someone like Lacan especially.
Do you think Lacan could be a good DoorDash therapist?
No, he would never accept it, would he?
why not?
Well, yeah, first of all, he had to be a doctor. You're already like, I'm not being a doctor, so let's start there.
Okay.
Like, they go to med school, fuck that.
Mm-hmm.
So he put in the labor to be a medical doctor, then he hustled to do this. He had something to prove.
Okay, and there it wouldn't pay him well enough, and the prestige wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, like, would if he did do it.
Oh, I see.
You know, could he be effective? Could he deliver therapy to people through that method? Could it work?
I would say I would almost sound like a parent if he wanted to. I would, but really, you know, if he wanted to do that, he could do a 45-minute session. You know, if he wants to end after 5 minutes, he only gets paid for 5 minutes. So.
Oh well, yeah, see, yeah.
I don't think he'd like that.
No. No. So, but what about the patient? Do you think the patient would be able to experience what Lacan was trying to offer, giving them these poetic ideological glasses?
They would miss the experience of being in his office with the open door, with the ringing telephone. This is, like I said, this is the poetic essence of Lacan, right? Mm. Which is just like larger than life. So they would miss all of that. I like convenience, pragmatism, maybe because I'm American. I like the kind of pragmatic nature of it. I think we can still have a rational conversation. And I don't feel that the essence of what I think therapy should be about is.
The therapy I've had has been mostly like this. Like,
yeah.
Like I'm sitting here with this freaking microphone and, you know, like this. But a few times, like I would say maybe 3 times, I've actually gone into the office.
Yeah.
And it is a very different experience to be in that office.
Sure.
It feels more like a doctor's visit.
Yeah.
Rather than a conversation between more relative equals. So there's a subordination that takes place when you go to him and go to his office.
Sure. Wait in the waiting room.
Wait in the waiting room. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I feel like all of that is part of the therapeutic process, weirdly. And so I part of me would, I mean, I could go in, but I've decided not to because I'm a very busy man. I don't have time to trek all way across town if I can just telecommute to this therapeutic appointment where I have a conversation.
Sure. Well, I think the question is, is it worth it for you to have that experience, which is, you know, like I said, it's the poetic, there is a poetic something to surplus to it.
Right. Yeah. I have to think about that. Maybe I'll go in next week. Probably not. But let's see here. Listen, this has been a really interesting conversation. I think you should definitely come back, because here's what I experienced with you, Elliot. I tried to explain what you're doing, and you refuse my explanation and redirect it to in a different way. But I feel like we're at the same time. I am understanding what you're getting at, but you're very, maybe you are just a therapist. Like, you know, you're not going to let me stay just within my own power.
Simply a therapist. Well, yeah, it works well. You know who doesn't let you stay in your own powers either is internet trolls. There's lots of things that don't let you stay in your own power. Your boss.
Yeah. Like that. So I feel like we should do this again and keep hashing this out. And also, you know, you're a good supplement to my more official established therapy.
And
I want to end this first half on going back to grief and asking what it seems to me like when we were talking about grief at the beginning, there was a complicated self-interest at work around grief. Like you didn't know the part of the problem was you weren't sure someone who's grieving isn't quite sure what is in their self-interest.
There's this essential grief process, which is it's universal. That's why there's a chapter called Universal Movements, right? We can understand these things. It's not an archetype. There's an essential process going on, which is grief is pain and avoidance. And then there's different ways to deal with that. And oftentimes you do avoid grief because you have to avoid grief at different times. And then you think about, wait, am I actively avoiding grief? But as soon as you think that there's a catch 22, which is you're not at all avoiding it. You're in it. Right.
Right. During the process of my divorce, I'm going to reveal something personally here. During the process of my divorce, I told my ex, I said, what I would like to be is really angry with you.
Yeah.
I really just want to fill up with rage. I find myself filling up with rage, but I then reject that because I don't want to lose you in that. I don't want to lose the feeling that I'm really having of loss.
God, what a good guy you are, Doug. Fuck.
You think so?
I mean, I only have me for reference.
Right.
That's a very compassionate, I think that's a very compassionate
thing. But I didn't feel like I was being compassionate to her. Like it wasn't, I wasn't making things easier on her by doing that. Right. I was like saying, no, I'm not going to just, you're going to have to walk away knowing how I feel. You know, that was what it was about. But it was grieving for sure. And it was choosing grief over, it was choosing to prolong the grief at that moment rather than let it go through anger. There have been all these moments along the way where it would be easy to, and God, in my dreams sometimes, you know, violent dreams, but you know, all these moments along the way where you could choose, like, okay, we're going to go to war. Let's lawyer up. Let's make this as hostile as possible. And that's a way to avoid the grief of the loss, I think.
Interesting.
But I don't feel
anger as repression. Yeah, you're on to your own essence there. Anger as repression.
Right. Yeah. But what I'm afraid of is to basically to heal and lose the pain of the, because that means truly losing the old relationship altogether, which was defining who I was for a long time. And I feel as though that's got to be part of just the grief process for everybody, whether it's a divorce or you lose someone to death or You lose who you think you are. You're grieving maybe the loss of a way of life, or, you know, maybe you were deported and you're grieving, you know, your home. Yeah. There's still, there's this feeling of not wanting to give up the self. It's not in your self-interest.
Sure. But then there's also this other angle, which is the fact that when you lose something like that, like, I think losing your home is, I think, is the best analogy for all of it, because losing, it's your symbolic coordinates no longer function. So there's something beyond the pain. There's this dissociation, and not in a, like, a fun spaced out way, but like dissociation in your grasp, and it's not there. Right now you're functioning in a worse.
Yeah, you're
grabbing, like, at things which aren't there anymore, and you're like, okay, how do I function again? This is the hyper state idea again, which is there's this kind of objective outside or objective essential process.
Right, you're trying to figure out what's in your self-interest when key components of who you were. Like, for instance, belonging to a squad, right, is no longer there. So
sure,
yeah. Is that
belonging to a squad? Yeah, that's part, or like a friend group, right? Like a school friend group. It's not, but like, say you're in high school and you had certain friends, and maybe you're somewhat like me, where you're not in touch with all your high school friends. Now you have different coordinate. I'd say that. Maybe one or two. Now your coordinates of reality are just like not there. Now you have to figure out how to engage with the world.
Right? Yeah.
So there's, I would say to understand it as self-interest. So it's not, you don't have to come back to the signifier of self-interest always, because you're immediately talking about self-interest when you're talking about grasping onto reality again.
All right. Well, listen, let's end the first half here, but rather than giving you a second stream to go to, let's just keep it going. Let's keep the conversation going.